This is Fresh Air. Novelist Robert Stone has said he's always trying to get at some essential truth about America, whether writing about the dark side of New Orleans, war-torn Central America, or the phony glamour of Hollywood. His novel about Vietnam, Dog Soldiers, won a National Book Award and was made into the movie Who'll Stop the Rain. Robert Stone is an ex-Navy man who fell in with the Merry Pranksters in the early 60s and used a lot of mind-expanding drugs. He now lives a more settled life in Connecticut. His latest novel, Outer Bridge Reach, is based on the true story of Donald Crowhurst, who wanted to sail around the world and entered the Golden Globe circumnavigational race in 1969.
He talked his way into this race. He was really not a very good sailor, not a very experienced sailor at all. Managed to talk his way into the race. Once underway, he found that he was out of his league. His rigging was working itself into knots that he couldn't resolve. He just was not about to win, not about even to finish. So he began to send out false position reports, giving the authorities of the race to understand that he was working his way around the Cape of Good Hope and completing the race, when in fact he was just hiding outside the shipping lanes in the South Atlantic and hoping not to be spotted. And his plan was to continue this subterfuge while the other entrants sailed all the way around the world. And then he would leap out of cover. This was kind of a Rosie Ruiz,
yeah.
on a global scale that he was doing. And
did it work?
No, it didn't work. It didn't work because he lost his mind, perhaps from the math involved in faking his positions, doing algebraic calculations backwards, trying to find out what literally working the angles. There was too much math. He really probably wasn't capable of it anyway.
You've called Owen Brown, and he's the man in the story who decides, even though he's never sailed before, that he's going to try to sail around the world. You've called him the most difficult character you've ever had to write. Do you know what made him so difficult for you?
What made him difficult was that his his circumstances and his are very different from mine. He's an Annapolis graduate. I mean, I was in the Navy. I went in the Navy as a seaman apprentice at 17. He is part of the suburban middle class, and that was not my background. A lot of things about him were, at first, or superficially, alien to me.
Is part of writing a character, getting to know a character, also liking him too? And I'm thinking about Owen Brown, who you say is so different from yourself.
I don't think you have to like your characters, your major characters, but I think you have to forgive them.
Forgive them.
Well, forgive them for being who they are. Uh-huh. I think it would be very difficult to summon up a major character, to create a major character who you could not really feel for on a serious level. That's what I mean by the necessity to forgive them. I think you have got to give them your blessing. You've got to accept them in spite of their problems.
You went to a Catholic school for some time in as a kid growing up in New York City. And yet it seemed as if, from what I read, that you fought against what they were teaching, I guess, whether it has to do with morality or spirituality. Can you describe what that early schooling was like for you?
Well, I started very young with the Marist Order, an order of teaching brothers. I went to one of their boarding schools when I was still 5 years old, and I spent the years 5 to 8 there. I absorbed a lot of religion very young, and I believed in it absolutely, and it became, and it remains, I suppose, a way of perceiving. It's something that you really cannot get rid of. For all your embracing of rationality and rationalism, you cannot really lose the religious conditioning. I reacted against it when I was in high school. I reacted against my religious teachers, because I really found a great deal in the Catholicism of the late 50s that I found repugnant and that I wanted to fight against. I left religion. I walked away from the Catholic religion about at the age of 16 with a great sense of liberation. What I didn't realize at the time, but have come to realize since, is that I walked away with half my head missing. I was liberated, but there was an enormous hole where large parts of me should have been that was swept away with that divorce.
Does that mean you've become a Catholic?
No. No, but I think I've remained a Jansenist. The Jansenist tradition of Catholicism was really the one I was raised in. In Jansenism, it is very, very difficult to be saved. It is all you can do to overcome your innate depravity. Original sin looms enormously around you. And I think, in a way, I for years I fought against that as undue pessimism, that horror of original sin. And then at a certain point, I don't know when, it began to seem to me to be, in a certain sense, true, independent of theological systems. There was something true about that. The necessity of behaving well and the great difficulty of it, the way in which so many parts of so many human impulses drive us against accepting a common condition with other people. This seemed to me to make enormous sense symbolically. And I think, even though I've stopped being a Catholic, I'm probably still a Jansenist.
I'm speaking with novelist Robert Stone, and he's written many novels, including A Hall of Mirrors, Dog Soldiers, which received a National Book Award, A Flag for Sunrise, Children of Light. And his latest book is called Outer Bridge Reach. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with novelist Robert Stone, and his latest book is called Outer Bridge Reach. I want to talk a little bit more about your growing up. Your mother was schizophrenic. She was a school teacher for a while and then lost her job because of her schizophrenia. What kind of a mother was she to you?
She was very affectionate. She was really, in her way, very caring. She was rather difficult to deal with sometimes. And she was also embarrassing to me. And I used to tell other kids when they met her that she was deaf, just trying to explain the kind of inappropriate responses and strange connections that she would make with things. But she was very well read. She was an educated woman. When she lost her job in the school system, things became very tight. I mean, our circumstances were much reduced, and she made her living hand addressing envelopes, paid by the thousand envelopes.
So you grew up poor?
Pretty poor. We had money week to week. She was paid by the thousand envelopes that she addressed. She had a very small pension from the school system, about $90 a month. And the rest was what she made hand-addressing envelopes. Her hands became very crippled. They became very twisted and arthritic as a result of doing this, just writing from 9 to 5 in longhand, addressing in longhand.
Did you worry about her as a child?
I worried about her, and I worried about us. I mean, at one time we were reported to the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. Which was ridiculous, really, because one thing she wasn't was abusive. But somebody got the wrong idea, so we found ourselves having to appear before the Children's Protective Society, and she picked this time to wear two different colored shoes. I mean, she had a brown shoe and a white shoe, which I didn't spot until we got there. I was around 11. And we'd come past the holding tank for kids who had been taken away from their keepers, from their parents. And the kids in there looked to me pretty tough. I didn't want to end up in there. And so I had to sort of do a little song and dance and try and distract the people from spotting her two different colored shoes. I mean, this kind of thing went on. I mean, in a way, it was it wasn't always heavy and gruesome. It was really never heavy and gruesome. It was pretty bearable and pretty light.
So how did you distract them from her two colored shoes?
Just by talking a lot, I think.
Well, did she have hallucinations?
Yeah, she had audio hallucinations. She used to hear things. She'd get into strange colloquies with voices from the past. One thing it did to me, was make me really closely examine my attitude toward reality, because hers was quite arbitrary, and there were times when I felt like I might somehow be drawn into hers.
Mm. Well, were you able to, as a child, enter her hallucinations? I mean, be able to talk to her about what she was hearing?
Yes, I could. There is a certain quality to schizophrenic speech and logic, which is recognizable if you've seen a lot of it. It has a curious, difficult to describe savor. One runs into it from time to time, and I can spot it because I remember it from a person who I lived on intimate terms with for years and years.
Is she still alive?
No, she died in 1971.
Robert Stone is my guest, and his latest book is called Outer Bridge Reach. Now, how did you meet Ken Kesey?
In 1962, I got a Stegner Fellowship on the basis of the beginning of my first novel. The Stegner Fellowships were granted by Stanford to support works in progress if they thought the works were worthy. And I was beginning A Hall of Mirrors, my first book. And I sent part of it to Stanford, and Stanford said, come out. So we moved out. I was married at that time, and still am. And my wife got a job key punching in Silicon Valley, and I went to classes at Stanford. And at that time, a lot of people I ran into were living in a little corner of Menlo Park, California, around a street called Perry Lane, and I began to go over there to visit and party, and that's where I met Kesey. Kesey was living on Perry Lane at that time. He had just been working as an orderly in the Veterans Hospital at Palo Alto, and he was at that time at work on Sometimes a Great Notion, his second novel. Hmm.
Well, you did a lot of drugs then, a lot of hallucinogenic drugs. How did that change your view of reality? And we were talking earlier about your mother's schizophrenia as a way of kind of entering another kind of reality. Did drugs give you another way to get into another kind of reality?
Yes, in a way they did. They certainly explained a number of things to me about delusional systems. They also seemed to confirm certain attitudes toward life and the world that I had, I think, drawn from my religious phase. It seemed to me that there were underlying mysteries that had to be accepted, that could not be reasoned aside. I mean, in terms of the intellectual content of those psychedelic trips, I think that was one thing that came to me, the sense of underlying mysteries.
Why did you stop taking drugs?
Well, for one thing, I think at a certain point it becomes frightening. It also becomes a lot of work. I mean, to take those psychedelics in those days, I mean, you were gone for 12 hours. You could wake up in the morning and your jaws hurt. You had no idea why, and you'd realize that because you'd been smiling from 10 o'clock in the morning until 10 o'clock at night. It was a lot of work. It took a lot of energy. And at a certain point, I think, you know, you think, do I really want to experience the rebirth of the universe when I instead might go down and shoot some pool, you know, or swim a couple of laps? I think you just unless there's some, you know, unholy fascination there that you cannot leave alone, and I think that happened to some people in the early 60s.
There's something that you said I want to ask you about, and this is talking about Outer Bridge Reach, your latest book, and you say it's really a continuation of the same themes that I've always dealt with, the ways in which people come through for each other or fail to, and the ways in which people are always offering something more than they can deliver. Do you feel like you're writing that those are the themes that you've been writing about?
Yes, about what one person seeks from another, the ways in which we seem to promise things that we can't always deliver on. The way in which we're stuck with each other for company, for love, for everything. We have only each other, which is, and that's both the problem and its resolution. This ongoing process where we share the world with other people. I mean, which it's, you know, in one vision, it's hell. In another aspect, it's great.
Well, Robert Stone, I thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed it too.
Robert Stone's latest novel is called Outer Bridge Reach. This is Fresh Air.